kuvekazu mushorsam ktizenketu eben aluliak samara nem ayan lot. In other words, if you are 12 years old or younger, you should be in school and not listening to this radio show.
You're not dumb enough to actually try it.
Welcome to the October 8th, 2012 edition of Mindenki Yoga. This is JD.
Interrupting all programs. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite.
On this edition of Mindenki Yoga, we will have a conversation with Duncan, an Irishman that's living in Spain, and he's going to talk about the massive protests in Madrid and Barcelona, as well as other places in the country. And then we're going to listen to a piece from the Real News Network, where Paul J. Interviews Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's going to be discussing a prisoner that was released from Guantanamo Bay, Gulag there, a prisoner who was there, he was put there when he was 15 years old, I think in 2001, just at the beginning of after 9/11. And also he's going to be talking about the Julian Assange case and some other cases that are important that have been in the news recently. And then we'll listen to Democracy Now, the discussion of the Afghan war, which the 2000th American soldier was killed in the Afghan war. So now we're going to talk to Duncan, and I met Duncan many years ago, 8, 9, 10 years ago or something in Ireland when I lived there, and he's since that time I've moved to Hungary, and since then he's moved to Spain, where he's married to a Spanish woman and has a family there, and he's still involved in activism, and so I talked to him on Skype about what the situation is in Spain. Talked about a number of things. One is like, why are they doing the massive protest again? You might remember a year ago there was a huge protest in Spain, the Indignado movement that was called, and it was mostly Spanish students that were upset because they could see that the austerity was coming down. And whether it was the socialist PSOE party that was elected or whether it was the conservative populist party was going to be elected, the same result was going to happen. So it really wasn't much of a democratic choice for them. And the Spanish students here in Budapest also had their own protest at the Gudur Club, or in Ezsebetér, which you might remember I interviewed them at the time. But so Duncan is going to talk to us about like what's going on in Barcelona, which is where he's based, which is in Catalonia, which is an autonomous area of the Kingdom of Spain, but it's still part of Spain. He's also going to talk about like one interesting thing that's popped out of this conflict that he's going to talk about is that the independence movement for Catalonia has been revived and looks very serious again. And it seems to come and go through in history, but it seems to be coming back very strongly again. And in 2014... Or no, maybe next year. Sorry, next year, there's going to have a independence referendum, and this is as a result of this financial crisis that's going on. And the Catalonia area seems to be the most the more economically viable than other parts of the country. I don't understand Spain very well, so I'm not going to step out of my bounds here, but it looks very interesting. And I would like to also somehow do a show on Scotland, because Scotland is also going to have a referendum in 2014 about whether or not they want to break away from the United Kingdom. So, you know, within a couple years, the EU, which is 27 states, might end up being, what would that be, 29 states. Without any new states joining it, but just simply states breaking apart from within. It's a very interesting situation. And all of this, hopefully, can happen nonviolently. But this is the question that Duncan's going to talk about is, you remember, just like Greece, Spain, not too long ago, had a very strong fascist military government, and the transition to democracy has not been easy. And these tough economic times are causing a lot of stress. Okay, enough. Let's talk to Duncan, who's talked to me on Skype. He's in Barcelona. Here's Duncan.
Duncan, thank you for coming on the Mindenki Yoga radio show. Please tell us about yourself. You're from Ireland originally, but you're living in Barcelona, Spain now. So what's brought you to Barcelona?
I've been here about 6 years now. So I suppose it's been six interesting years with all the changes that have been going on in Spain in that time. I work in kind of ecology areas, different sort of activist groups, and it's some very amazing things going on in Spain, but also some pretty crazy things going on and a few frightening things going on as well.
We've been watching the news about these large crowds trying to surround the parliament building, and of course, there is the Indignado movement in the past, which there was some effort to kind of replicate that here in Budapest about a year ago. But there was some inspiration that came this way as well. But so, what are you seeing there?
Well, I suppose things have changed over the last few years. May just gone, but the year before. So I suppose nearly 15 months ago was on the 15th of May. That was the start of the Indignados movement. That's when people took to the public squares, demonstrating in the streets. But the difference is they didn't go home. People stayed in the squares, occupying the squares, and open up in dialogue about what exactly is going in Spain, where's this money going, what can be done to move things forward. And it really was a very, very inspirational time. There was a lot of different stuff going on. There was a fair bit of police violence as well against people. Anyway, it kept on going on, and it's moved into different sorts of areas. Since then, I suppose things have quieted down, and it's like from the end of maybe July, the 3 months after, people started going back to the local neighborhoods and trying to actually build up alternatives. So we're seeing lots of, I suppose, little things starting to happen between different groups. But now in the last few days, it's become very much back on the streets again. Here in Spain, kind of August time, people sort of switch off. There's a lot of people are going away from the cities and stuff like that. So it really is a kind of off time. And then after that, now it's like, you know, the street festivals are over here and things are back to normal again. And with that, there was, you know, this big call for the Surround the Congress in Madrid. And then we just saw huge police violence. And like what's come out now from the last while is the fact that, you know, like everybody saw these pictures on TV of these, you know, the guys with the like dressed block with red and black flags smashing the police and the police smashing back. But now there's a lot of videos and photographic evidence showing that, you know, that a lot of those guys with the flags who were smashing the police were undercover police, because we see them later with the same clothes on making arrests and dragging people undercover out from the crowd. So this has been reported in the mainstream Spanish media. And just yesterday, it's the first time that I see that this has been making its way into the English-speaking media. I'm not sure about Hungarian media yet, but hopefully it will get there, because this is really... just shows the level of dirty tricks that are being used in Spain to try to discredit these social movements that, you know, have been explicitly peaceful since the Indignado started off. And I think that's been a very wise decision. Personally, as a pacifist, I've seen in Ireland, well, if you go down the violent road and you're really going to go down that road, what it leads to. And you know, that I don't think would lead to anything healthy here in Spain, given the divisions that still kind of exist here after the Civil War. There's always fears that there could be more really strong fights between different sides. You know, it's there's still a lot of messy things in Spain.
Well, if you could answer me a very naive question, and that is, why do you think the police, and I guess the police wouldn't act alone, would they? I mean, why would the police want to have a violent situation?
Well, just yesterday we see basically the staged little spectacle they made. Basically, they create a violent situation. The people see the images of the violent activists hitting the police. The police don't have an excuse to deal with this violent group. And like when the Spanish police, when they hit back, they really, really, they go very intense. So we've seen images of the police going into the train station, shooting rubber bullets all over the train station. A lot of bystanders were injured. But basically what we see yesterday is that they're trying to push for a new law, trying to ban protesting, peaceful protest. And this is just a serious crackdown on civil liberties. Like, this is the most right-wing government in Spain since the end of fascism. So, if this is part of their ploy to try to crack down on what is still a very successful movement, but it's also, it has been growing and it has been broadening its abilities to try to make change, you know, to deal with the crisis, because, you know, people in Spain are hurting very badly because of the crisis. And, you know, like a year after May 15th, the result was that over 70% of the Spanish people are still in support of these, you know, the indignados, the 15M, the what's going on. So obviously it's in the government's interest to try to crack down on that and to have less people participating, to stop the numbers growing and growing on the streets as the crisis is getting worse and worse. So that's my take on it anyway. So, because it's not the first time that we've seen this. Like in Barcelona, June the year before, we saw a similar sort of action where police undercover were sent in to create a violent situation. But later on, you know, the rest of the crowd turned around and saying, like, guys, what are you doing? This is a peaceful demonstration. And then these radical demonstrators suddenly start speaking into their wrists and start masking themselves up, and suddenly a riot squad zoom out, catch them, and bring them behind police lines. And then later we see these same people making arrests. So it's a clear dirty tricks tactic being used by the Spanish state, and also like in the, you know, the more autonomous states like here in Catalonia.
Well, two questions I have for you. I mean, can you describe the crisis, the economic crisis, a little bit, like just in terms of how it affects you and how it affects your family and friends?
Yeah, well, like I myself, well, I originally was working here and kind of as an ecological architect. Crisis came, lost my job. This time year and a half ago, I was teaching English. The people I was teaching, a lot of office world, lost their jobs. A lot of my friends who were Latin American have gone back to Latin America because the situation is better in terms of getting a job, getting work. You see it on the streets. Like, you just take a look around and like the opposite corner from where I live, you know, there's like, and not just here, but in many zones where I live, you've old abandoned little corners of the city that have been taken over, squatted ground, people, you know, moving in and building basically shanty towns, little favelas in different corners of the city. These are they're known as the barracas. We're seeing, many, many people losing their jobs, people not being able to pay their mortgages, being sent out onto the streets because of the repossessions from the banks taking our houses. So you're definitely seeing it. Like, you know, every second day you walk through the main square to go to work, like today, you know, there's what, 10 riot vans, there's barricades outside of two political buildings, there's riot police there fully kitted up, you know, a few with guns, there's ambulances behind that waiting just in case anything kicks off. So, you know, this is a normal occurrence. You come through the streets and you see maybe 100,000 people wearing yellow T-shirts. That's just the education people protesting against the attempts, you know, first of all, the massive cuts in the education sector, and then the further attempts to try to privatize it off, you know. So people are resisting as best they can. Lots of people haven't been paid, public workers. We're seeing police in the streets demonstrating against police because the police as public like workers of the state, you know, they're losing their jobs. They're being affected by cuts as well. You know, in terms of the amount of demonstrations that have been on, you know, a huge amount with massive participation. Like you're a big, you know, there's a big demonstration on and, you know, you might have, I don't know, 250,000 people, you know, that's a normal sort of going on. As I said, like with the Indignados, most of the time it has been peaceful, but we had a general strike in Spain in the end of March, just a few months back. And here in Barcelona, like that went crazy. The top of the Ramblas, if people know the top of the Ramblas and Plaza Catalunya, you know, like there was a serious amount of anger. People are really angry here. So there was fires in the streets. There was police coming in really heavy-handed, but being repelled by, you know, violent protesters. There was banks smashed, set on fire. The Starbucks was blown up. Rubber bullets being fired for over 3 hours. A lot of injuries. Two people are left blind after getting shot in the face with rubber bullets. You know, that's kind of the way it's going here, and most people feel that it's just going to continue getting worse as the cuts are getting deeper and deeper. And now, you know, there's talk of actually looking for a full bailout, and if that's taken, then there's obviously going to be lots of, you know, Spain's going to have to make a lot of structural adjustments to meet the demands of Troika and the banks, etc. So I don't know. It's a lot of people here are feeling desperate. And
what is the situation with, I mean, it's a very big topic, but the Catalonia thing and the potential independence.
Yeah.
What is, well, that's, this?
It's been very interesting to see that as well. Like, obviously, coming from Ireland and the history that Ireland has had, you know, there's obviously certain similarities you can see somewhat, but I don't see it in the same way. But yeah, I think it surprised everyone, the big demonstrations that were on September 11th, which is the Catalan National Day. Basically, like, you know, everybody knew it was going to be big, the big demonstration looking for independence. But they were kind of going, you know, we'll probably have 1 million people. That was the big talk. But in the end, it was over 2 million people in the streets. And these are people asking, you know, demanding independence.
This is independence, or is this more autonomy?
This is people looking for, like, the independence of Catalonia from the Spanish state. So actually leaving the Spanish state and making a new country of Europe, a new state of Europe. So that's why the flags around town, they say, like, Catalonia, new state of Europe. The government in power at the moment, CiU, it's a right-wing Catalan nationalist. They've never had really made big claims to actually ask for full independence. They just want a more, I suppose, a federal system like you have in the States, where, you know, they've got the autonomy to organize their own economic affairs, their own laws, etc., etc. There has been a lot of changes in the last few years since 2004, but basically, like maybe 10 years ago, there was only about 15% of the Catalans saying yes to independence. And these would have been more hardcore sector of society. People see them quite radical. But then it jumped over 2 years ago because of some of the changes that had happened in between years to about 25%. And now for the first time we see in the polls that it's actually gone over 50%. So that's, you know, like that's a sharp kind of spike that we're seeing in the rise of people looking for independence. Part of the reason why people are moving here is the economic situation, because Catalonia is probably the richest in terms of generator of wealth in Spain from tourism, from industry, from research. But a lot of one of the claims is that all the taxes that they generate, they just go to Madrid and then nothing comes back. Where, for example, the other parts of Spain, you know, people look at, say, the other official recognized nations of Spain, which are the Basque region and Galicia, you know, where they've got people would see it that they've got a better deal, that they're keeping their taxes. So that's part of the driver, but it's not the only driver. The economic system is not the only driver. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, you go back 5-10 years, times are good. Like in Ireland, there was a bubble here, so speculation bubble. So, you know, there was money, there was lots of credit. But now times are tight. People are in this difficult moment. They're not fully sure where their next meal is coming from, if there's money for their work, if they have work even. So with that, people are asking questions, and maybe with that, people are seriously thinking about, you know, the relationship between Catalonia and Spain. But in terms of what it's provoked, like it was only last Thursday, I think, here in Catalonia when the Parliament voted in favour of a referendum next November for the Catalan people to make a decision about where they want to go, to see if more people want to actually have an independent state. But the rest of Spain, like the Spanish government from Madrid, from the central government, they've said that that won't be allowed, that that's not, it's not, it'll be an unlawful act, that it, the constitution doesn't permit it. As well as that, and this is quite worrying because when you understand Spain's history, like there was an attempted coup in 1981, the coup of 1936 led to the civil war, which, you know, Franco took power, lots of really dark things went on in those times. But with all these changes of Catalonia's talk of independence, we see certain areas of the military group, a group AME, and they've talked about that if these traitors of Spain try to fracture the Spanish state, that then, you know, that they'll be dealt with. So nobody's fully sure what that means, but, you know, could it mean violent acts against the Catalan independence movement? Could it mean an attempted coup? Who knows? You know, it's Spain really feels like it's in a very strange moment here at the moment, with so many different things pulling Spain in different ways.
Sounds very similar to Greece in this respect. People talking about potential coups, and like in the past as well, but who's behind the shadows or who's behind the door and all this type of stuff. You know, in the old days you could have a coup to solve these problems, so-called, but it's hard to imagine this even happening in 2012.
Yeah, but you'd never know. Like, it's Europe seems to be pretty crazy. You know, when you look at, see, in Greece, for example, you've got, you know, what, 7 up to maybe 10% now support for Golden Dawn. You know, it's strange times in Europe. And I think Greece is hurting a lot more. And I think the people are really feeling the pain of having massive cuts, no money coming, et cetera, et cetera. Spain is feeling it, but maybe not as much as Greece. But I suppose one thing I would like to say is that it's not all bad. Like, you know, a lot of time, especially in English, you know, we look at crisis as being, you know, this thing which is only a negative thing. But, you know, you look, say, go back thousands of years to China, you see, you know, it's a time of danger, but also a time of opportunity. So, you know, for me, I'm working with the ecological groups I've worked with for a long time. You know, we're actually seeing a great time of change as well, like almost like a paradigm shift, a mind change in many people, where they're becoming open to ideas which in the past they'd never have even thought about, because, you know, they'd no need to think about things. But now people are in serious difficulty. They're looking for ways to, you know, sort of feed their families. It's something as basic as that. So we're seeing, you know, community gardens, we're seeing food cooperatives, we're seeing housing cooperatives, we're seeing people coming together and looking at trying to create solutions. So there's actually some very, very interesting and positive things coming out of this crisis. So that's one of the positives that's coming out of it.
Part of the Indignado thing was this kind of idea of, I don't know, this vague concept of real democracy or some kind of other kind of democracy. From your perspective, what are people discussing in terms of?
Well, I think those ideas, I think, are very specific to Spain, because just briefly, like, the, you know, Franco died 75, then it was a 3-year discussion that was the transition movement moving from fascism to democracy. But there was a lot of give and take, a lot of deals were done to enable this transition. So a lot of people feel that this, even though we're officially in democracy in Spain, that it's not maybe a full democracy, because certain elements of the old school, old guard were still held in place. Like, for example, especially the judicial system. You see Julian Assange there, you know, that what came up there in recent months. So here in Spain, people say that, you know, the way that the political system is organized, that it's not fair, that it can be improved upon. So that's one side of it. But then there's also the wider side of actually moving far, far beyond than the system that we're used to in Spain and in other parts of the Western developed world, to actually a far more inclusive, a far more participative system where more people are having a say. So the idea behind that, I suppose, is, you know, taking it back to local communities and trying to have some sort of mechanisms to that people have more of a say in sort of the governorship of the world that they're living in. And there is precedent for this, because here in, like in Barcelona, it's the last city in Western Europe to have gone through a full-on revolution. And it was actually in, and as many people will know, I'm sure, your listeners, it was an anarchist-inspired revolution. So, you know, a lot of people here, they have an understanding of some of the basics of what this type of method of organization meant. So they're not such crazy, strange ideas here. Like you talk to a lot of people, especially the older generation, you know, they've come through the 70s. They've come through the severe beatings that were being dealt out by the police in the streets when people were asking for simple rights to be respected, you know. So here, like I said, you know, that even though there's a, you know, there is a kind of vague ness to the Indignados cause, some see that as a weakness, some see that as a strength, because it's actually trying to move beyond where we are now into like a deeper political space and mechanism.
And well, this real democracy idea, I mean, this is of the kind of the local Occupy Hungary movement. They throw this phrase around a lot, but I don't know. In my opinion, there's not much depth to the question here anyways, but it sounds much more historical there. What you said about the transition from fascism to democracy and how the old system holds over, and I mean, you just take out the word fascism and put in communism or socialism, and you would be talking about Hungary. I mean, it's a, you know, the change from one regime to another, you know, this seems to have the same issues here.
Yeah. Well, I think the, you know, you look at any system which has been pretty totalitarian, where people haven't had a voice and, you know, their basic rights being respected and not able to do anything about it, really. That's what people were stuck in Spain for up to 40 years, you know, and probably the same in most of the Eastern Bloc, you know, from the friends I have from those countries, you know, you hear that the you know, the dark days that people were in. I suppose now where we are, you know, maybe you'd argue it's a better place. I think it is a better place, but of course it can be improved. And that's really part of the argument, what's going on here. Not only that it could be improved, but it has to be improved. So, you know, people are doing what they can to push this forward. And I don't know, like for me, it's interesting the fact that, you know, a year after the Indignados, you know, started all their demonstrations, like in my square here in Plaza Catalunya, you know, I stayed there many nights myself. You know, there was hundreds of people living in the square for May, June, July. You know, you'd sit down in the square one evening, there could be 4,000 or 5,000 people sitting around the square with you. We had a live video connection with Syntagma Square in Athens, you know, having to go forward and back. There's people in Greece telling us what's gone on in the day there, us giving a feedback there. There's been a huge amount of kind of, you know, ideas and experiments going on. But for me, the beauty is, you know, after a year, because, you know, there's a lot of cynicism here in the Spanish media as well. And go, this Indignados thing, you know, it's come and gone. It just sort of sparked and fizzled. But, you know, after a year, there was over 70% of support from the Spanish people for this movement. You know, where you see, you know, a few months later, a lot of it, what happened here was later to inspire the whole Occupy movement in New York, which, you know, really sent everything global. And we were very much inspired by what's gone on in both North Africa with the start of the Arab Spring, but also Iceland. You know, where in Iceland, people, okay, obviously it's a smaller country, but people, you know, got up off their behinds, went and tried to change the system around. And for the most part, they have started that process. They have changed things around. The people have rewritten the constitution. That's been one of the major drivers for this Surround the Congress in Madrid last Tuesday. It was basically saying, look at Iceland did, and let's go and do the same. Because the constitution here, it's a big talking point. You know, a lot of people feel, you know, it was part of this deal that had to be done coming out of fascism. So maybe it's time to improve it. So, but obviously, as I said, you know, certain elements in Spanish society will resist that, and possibly with violence.
Wow. Duncan, thank you very much for joining us on the show. And, you know, I hope you will talk to us again soon and give us more reports about what's going on the ground there.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to keep in touch and keep it all up. So, cussing them to you, and
very good.
Have a little drink and a little eggy shegadra. So, many years since I've passed through Budapest, but I had good times. I had actually said some people from Budapest on my tour today. So I'm a tour guide at the moment. That's what I survive off.
That was Duncan from Barcelona, Spain. Thank you, Duncan, for being on the show. We really must talk more. Fascinating stuff. I think there's a lot of interesting parallels of Spain's transition to capitalism, democracy, or whatever it is currently now, and Hungary's also transition. I think it's just a very interesting. A lot of the things he said about the old regime holding out and the new regime and all this stuff. Anyways, we'll talk again. I hope in the soon. Let's listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to listen to a piece from the Real News Network. Bapiko, Muchina Muchinana, when I jump Kampala Kujinja, Mubuka, and then I dance on the Yaniga, when I jump, Nalin's Rock Street for Baringa and Jacapia, Red Bull, Owen City Day, when we're not going to go, Bakwecho, Police Valiba and Quata, Awa Aido, Eda Wenarumo, Nana Echibinja, Chababuka, Nobutusanachiro, Wedusa, Wedjikutambuza, Eda Mama Kusumero Yari, and Tuarana Chiboko, Nansa de Balanci, and Yamba de Smati, when you did Amukirasi, Basomeso Navanja, end of the Yat, Tamu Wako, Usomero, Vantenda. I would the way we played out, Nina Okuja Yansi, Nini Sekumbera, we no Utawera. Okukura Mumbera, the Chibuka, Kosichangu, Kubuli, and Kuteke Zanti, Yantukako, Yoko Sato Izava to say, Kosichangu, Kubuli, and Kuteke Zanti, Yantukako, Walakasasi, Okucharo, Yantukako. Yeah, Unudano, Anyang Chon, we are big black, Akecha, Aberuku group, we are my rich, we are my wiggy jay fan, we are my madun jay, Sawan police, Makua, Sawan, Chirukunanina, but then the disco, we go Kumegua, Rongo, we are big black, Akecha, Aberu Chalu, American boys, Magiti, California, and Abutu Illusera Wangapar, Roman Urupe, and Dano Gibegilunga, Rasta Nigga, Rapper Hustler, you call to a Marine Mahawk, Buff Bedlocks, and Aberuku group, we are my rich, we are my want to put that too, don't think Abika Kuyo Mongo, Ojumakuri Mumeke, Achirina Mirepe. Archbishop, work it up to the Omega. Mungu, work it up to the Omega. Anginya, adu bibi ngomeni. Dano muke de to, renong duwa kungo pitu bumege. Okukura mumbera zeche bubuka. Gosi changu, nkubuli na nkuteke zanti. Yantukako, yoko zato izava tuze. Gosi changu, nkubuli na nkuteke zanti. Yantukako, wala kasasiro kucharo. Yantukako. Hey guys, this is your man MC Ken Babu, made in black, with the youngsters, the Basagala Mania Squad, big up to JT, Diego Production. Okay, next we're going to listen to a piece from the Real News Network where Paul Jay interviews Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States. And he's going to talk about a Guantanamo prisoner that was finally released, as well as a Julian Assange case and some other cases that I think are very interesting and important. That's what's going on in the news. So here's the Real News Network.
Welcome to the Real News Network, and welcome to this week's segment of the Ratner Report with Michael Ratner, who now joins us from New York City. Michael is the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and he's a regular contributor to the Real News Network. He's also a member of the board of the Real News Network. Thanks for joining us again, Michael.
Always good to be with you, Paul.
And I guess I should mention, although I don't, that you're also the U.S. Attorney for Julian Assange. So what do you got for us this week?
Well, it's been an interesting week, particularly in how low the U.S. has fallen in terms of what other countries think about its human rights situation and what the U.S. has done post 9/11 in terms of both imprisonment and torture. And just let's talk about three cases that have all come up this week. One is the case of Omar Khadr, who was taken in Pakistan by the United States as a 15-year-old, sent to Guantanamo and tortured. Finally, he has been sent to Canada. We'll talk about his case. We'll talk about five Muslims who are resisting extradition to the United States from the United Kingdom. The U.S. has asked for their extradition. And of course, one of their big claims is they will be tortured in the United States. And then we're also talking about Julian Assange. One of his claims is that he will also be imprisoned in a way that constitutes torture in the United States. These three cases have all been condemned. Their treatment has all been condemned by Amnesty International and other groups. So let's go to the first one, Omar Khadr. Omar Khadr, 15 years old, picked up in 2002 in Afghanistan as a 15-year-old, alleged to have thrown a grenade that killed a U.S. Marine or a U.S. soldier, taken to Guantanamo, not given a trial, but kept in either tortured conditions or very harsh conditions. There's a video of Omar Khadr that people can see on the web, shows him just crying for his mother when he's 15 or 16 years old. At 15 years old, he should have been treated as a, quote, child soldier. He should not have been mixed with other populations. He should have been rehabilitated. But the U.S., which is a signatory to the treaty, refused to do so and essentially interrogated him and allegedly tortured him along with the Canadians. Finally, after 8 years of this stuff, Omar Khadr in 2010 is forced to plead guilty, pleads guilty to an eight-year sentence. A year of it's supposed to be done in Guantanamo, 7 years in Canada. Canada didn't want Omar Khadr. They kept resisting the Conservative government of Canada. Well, you're Canadian, Paul. You know about these things. The Conservative government of Canada refuses to take him. Finally, after 2 years, the Conservative government does take Omar Khadr back, where he will now do seven more years. But his story is illustrative. Here's the U.S. violating the law on child soldiers, the U.S. violating the law on never giving him a trial, the U.S. violating the law on the custodial conditions he's under, taking him to an offshore facility, and then essentially forcing a young man to plead to something like a 15 or 17 year sentence because he was given no credit for the time he served.
And what sparked the deal now? I mean, there's been a lot of criticism that Canada did very little for Khadr over the last years, where a lot of other Western nations with similar prisoners, people from their countries, intervened more, and Canada kind of kept its hands off this for most of this time.
Hands off would be a generous way of describing what Canada did. My guess is, and what it seems to have been written about, is that Canada didn't want him back and made sure he wasn't going to be sent back to Canada. And I think your example is a good one. The British insisted. There was a lot of support for this in Britain, but because of opposition, because of street demonstrations and everything, the British insisted on getting their British citizens back, or almost every one of them. And that's what happened. And they got them back within a year or two. And I actually remember seeing those people in Britain. Canada was different. Canada hated the Khadr family. Omar Khadr's father was, openly a member of Al-Qaeda, was eventually killed. And they blame the father's, they blame the son for the father's sins. This kid is taken to Pakistan when he's a kid by his father. He's put into a firefight. There probably isn't even if he threw the grenade, it shouldn't be a crime. It's in a war. They charge this 15-year-old. So Canada has been worse than imaginable, really, in terms of their citizen, Omar Khadr. But he's at least back in a prison in Canada now. And the question is, will he really have to do 7 years in some maximum security prison in Canada? He obviously shouldn't have to. He was a child soldier. He should have been rehabilitated. And that's still what Canada ought to do. So we go from that case of U.S. treatment of Omar Khadr, as well as Canadian Canadians' failure to really protect their own citizens, to the cases that are now pending in the United Kingdom. They've been pending for 7 or 8 years. Five Muslim men, one of them, Bakar Ahmed, who's sort of well-known of the five, have been resisting extradition to the United States for this entire period. The United States wants them on some kind of formulated crimes having to do with terrorism. The case went through the UK courts. It then went to the European Court of Human Rights. In the European Court of Human Rights, the five argued that they should not be sent to the United States because they would be subject to torture. Not just the classic torture we've been reading about it that the United States did in the past, waterboarding and the like, but that the prison conditions they'd be under at a prison called ADX Florence, which is essentially an underground maximum security isolation prison, that the conditions they'd be under amounted to cruel inhuman treatment or torture. 23 hours a day, very little exercise, no communication. They took that to the European Human Rights Court under Article 3 of the European Convention on Rights. Incredibly, the European Court of Human Rights said that it didn't amount to torture, that while it was close, it was this, it was that, that they could be extradited to the United States. I think what's significant is first that it was considered a very serious issue, the way the U.S. keeps prisoners, particularly from abroad, particularly Muslims, in ADX Florence with no communication, with no ability to talk to other prisoners, and in 23 hours a day solitary. I think the European Court was dead wrong. It was a political decision. The European Court of Human Rights is under tremendous pressure, particularly in the United Kingdom. When I was there, they had a picture of the judges on the court calling them clowns. This is before the decision. So that decision, though, is an indication not the decision, but the resistance to what disrepute the United States is now held in with regard to its own prison conditions. So that's the case of the five. They haven't been extradited yet. They're making last appeals into the British courts. But they had an interesting ally, and that's newsworthy this week. Juan Mendez, who's the UN rapporteur on torture, who was himself tortured in Argentina, he came out with a statement saying these people, these five, should not be extradited to the United States because they will be subjected to to the risk of torture in the United States, because the solitary confinement they will be put in, the lack of communications they will be under, their ability to do anything there may well constitute torture under the torture convention. So here you have the UN rapporteur saying we can't, people cannot be sent to the United States because they will be tortured in U.S. custody. Mm. Pretty remarkable. So that's two of the cases I wanted to mention. The third case concerns my own client, Julian Assange. Again, this is a remarkable thing that happened. Julian Assange has been, of course, resisting any kind of extradition to the United States. They haven't asked for his extradition yet, but as one of his lawyers, I know the U.S. is planning a prosecution or in the midst of getting an indictment against him and will try to get his extradition. The Amnesty International in the United Kingdom, but really the overall Amnesty International, issued a report this week saying Julian Assange, if he's sent to the United States, risks, first of all, persecution because of his free speech activities. In other words, WikiLeaks should be protected, and that Julian Assange risks being persecuted because of those activities. Not prosecuted, persecuted. And secondly, he also risks being tortured because he will be put into this ADX Florence or a similar prison, essentially underground, essentially to look at four walls, 23 or 24 hours a day, and essentially no communication with the outside world. And this is Amnesty International saying Julian Assange should not be extradited to the United States. So you have this incredible situation this week. Khadr put in Guantanamo, tortured or allegedly tortured there. The five from the UK, Juan Mendez, the UN rapporteur, saying not to be sent to the United States, risk of torture, and Amnesty International saying Julian Assange should not be sent to the United States, risk of torture. So what many people at least thought the United States stood for, which was a place of human rights, even if carried out more in the breach, no courts in the world, as well as Amnesty, UN rapporteurs, et cetera, are saying the U.S. no longer even stands for that. In fact, it stands for the opposite. The one bright spot, although you could say that Amnesty and the UN Rapporteur were bright spots here, the one bright spot is the case of Abu Omar. Abu Omar was the Egyptian cleric kidnapped off the streets of Milan, taken to Egypt and tortured. Amazingly, there was a prosecution in Italy of the 22 CIA agents and a U.S. military person, along with a bunch of Italian officials. They were convicted in absentia. They had to flee the country. They were convicted. And just last week, their convictions were upheld. They were given 7-year sentences. The station chief was given a 9-year sentence. They can never go back to any part of Europe again. Their names are known to the Italian prosecutors. And so that is a victory. It's the first victory against the U.S. rendition flights that took people to places of torture during the last 11 years. So it's an important victory. Right. You can just see how low, how very low the U.S. has fallen, Paul.
Thanks very much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News Network. And if you'd like to see more of reports like this, there's a donate button over here. If you don't click on it, we can't do this.
Okay, that was The Real News Network with Paul Jay. And I'll put all these links on the LMV, on the Mindenki Yoga blog. You can find it at lmv.hu/Mindenki Yoga, and you spell Mindenki Yoga like this, MINDENKIJOGA. And I'll put all these links and information there. And so let's listen to some music. And when we come back, we'll listen to Democracy Now, about the 2000th U.S. soldier who had died in the Afghan War.
Atención, se está cometiendo una tradición. Todo al son de esos aplausos, presos de la sinrazón por el sufrimiento de un ser vivo, sí, que al país de las sevillanas vino a encontrar su castigo por haber nacido torturado por la prepotencia de esa herencia familiar demencia. Tras un traje de luces, luce la bestia con gesto prepotente y una extensa colección de muertes por gentes llamadas fiestas. Confiesa la grada en el coliseo, aplauden la victoria del favorito en el duelo, que con fuego juega y que casi llega a la brutalidad de los tordesillanos con su Toro de la Vega. Venga, piensa en la imagen que con tanto orgullo cuentan los mismos que del friki eurovisivo se avergüenzan y lamentan la sangre en el ruedo de esos valientes, también acompañados y armados hasta los dientes. Siente el sistema nervioso del inocente. ¿Quién ve? Respeto en la tortura y en la muerte. Piense de arte y el arte es bien diferente. Pierde respeto por la vida y su corriente.
Torero, eres como un cero a la izquierda, pero todavía vales menos. Lo primero, decirte a la cara que no vales nada con esmero. Pero quitarte el capote y quemarlo luego. Compañero, sentirás el miedo. No mereces mi halago ni el ganar dinero. Por ejemplo, hazte barrendero o carpintero. Búscate un oficio más placentero. Por cierto, si crees que eres el dueño del mundo entero, mejor que aterrices en el suelo. Represento con orgullo al toro más fiero. Jodeos, fachas del medievo. Aquí nuestra lucha sigue su sendero. Por eso, quítate del medio, te lo ordeno, majadero. Saltaremos al ruedo, ganaremos el duelo. Venga, todos los pañuelos al cielo. Debo ponerme yo de cebo, y si lo celebro, que hay gente con cerebro, no como vosotros, calveros desespero. Ahora todos juntos por un mundo animal más serio.
La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura. La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura. La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura. La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura.
Torturadores, mala gente. Hablamos de toreros y taurinos claramente. Bajeza humana que emana de una patriótica moral decadente.
Todo consiste en un mal llamado arte. Odio, sufrimiento y nación como estandarte. Aderezado por asesinos adiestrados, ovacionados, aplaudidos, aclamados.
No busquéis su inteligencia, ni luces veréis en sus cabezas. Solo el traje las tiene con certeza. Lo suyo es la espada y el capote machote.
Con toda explicación la tradición, su mano alberga feliz
la mutilación.
Orejas cortadas con satisfacción,
gotean en su mano por la amputación.
Hoy hay corrida de beneficencia,
ira
irán a verla, el rey junto a los curas, fieles amantes de la tortura, pura herencia viva de la dictadura.
Aman al toro, eso explica todo, clavan su espada hasta el fondo.
Como en la violencia sexista,
la quería tanto que la maté porque era mía.
Era mía.
Se arrastra duras penas y tiembla, se eleva la vida, apenas respira. Con la columna vertebral partida, su piel echa jirones, encharcados sus pulmones. Sonriente, date una vuelta y créetelo, mientras suena un paso doble torero. Ufano de crueldad, galán, bailas tu himno rancio de ruedo.
Viene el diario, sección cultural.
Viene la crítica de un intelectual.
El mismo que clama se alarma,
se alarma. Si se habla de derecho animal.
De elegancia,
francia. La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura.
La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura.
La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura.
La tortura no es arte ni cultura. El torero es un valiente, no es basura.
Y tú, antitaurino, que gritas y gritas, no te olvidas de sus hembras y sus crías.
¿No te olvidas?
Ellas sufren igual o más, aunque los medios no lo retransmitan.
Pregúntate al criticar a los otros,
¿qué más da?
Si por su muerte has pagado en la taquilla de una plaza de toros o en la caja de un supermercado.
Supermercado.
Yeah.
Okay, next is Democracy Now, the October 2nd, 2012 edition of Democracy Now. Let's listen to Amy Goodman.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Washington, D.C.
The first presidential debate of this election is happening literally miles from both Columbine High School in Aurora, Colorado, two of the worst shootings in our country's history. This is a debate about domestic policy. You know, if there ever is a time to pose a question about gun policy in America to our candidates for president of this country, then this debate that's happening on Wednesday is the time to do it.
As President Obama and Mitt Romney prepare for Wednesday's debate in Denver, survivors of recent shooting massacres are urging moderator Jim Lehrer to ask the candidates about gun violence. We'll speak with Colin Goddard. He survived the 2007 shooting at Virginia Tech, and to poet and Virginia Tech professor Nikki Giovanni, who taught the shooter in her poetry class.
You're running for president, then tell me what you're going to do about it. Because if you're not concerned about gun violence, what in the world are you concerned about?
But first, as the U.S. death toll in Afghanistan tops 2,000, we speak with Phyllis Bennis about America's longest war. All that and more coming up. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's currency has hit an all-time low amidst a worsening financial crisis brought upon by U.S.-led sanctions. On Monday, the Iranian rial dropped more than 15% to its lowest point yet against the dollar, capping a three-month period that's seen its overall value drop 57%. The prices of basic food staples in Iran are said to be rising by the day since a new round of Western sanctions took effect in July. At a public event in Washington Monday, Thomas Pickering, a former U.S. ambassador to the UN and Undersecretary of State, criticized the sanctions, saying, quote, "We issue licenses for sales of food and medicine to Iran, but it is not legal for them to pay for it." Speaking, meanwhile, to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi said his government hasn't wavered from its renouncement of nuclear weapons.
If any country, including Iran, uses weapons of mass destruction, that is the end of the validity, eligibility, legality, whatever you name it, of that government. Weapons of mass destruction, as we said, is against humanity. It's something that is not at all acceptable.
The British, French, and German governments are expected to push for a further tightening of sanctions by the end of the month. Israel, meanwhile, is drawing little attention for refusing to take part in an upcoming conference on the establishment of a nuclear-free Middle East. The gathering scheduled for December in Finland under the auspices of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But at a recent meeting, Israeli nuclear chief Shaul Horev told diplomats that any deal for a nuclear-free zone under the UN would amount to, quote, external coercion, as opposed to local initiative. The Obama administration is reportedly considering whether to begin unilateral military strikes on alleged al-Qaeda targets in North Africa. The Washington Post reports the deliberations center around concern over al-Qaeda gains in Mali, as well as its acquisition of weapons from post-Gaddafi Libya. As part of its efforts in North Africa, the U.S. has launched secret intelligence operations, including the use of civilian aircraft to conduct surveillance over the Sahara Desert and the Sahel region. New figures show September was Iraq's deadliest month in more than 2 years. At least 365 people were killed in nationwide violence last month, more than half of them civilians. Nearly 700 people were wounded. At least three people were killed in a U.S. drone strike Monday in the Pakistani region of North Waziristan. The identities of the victims remain unknown. The strikes come as the anti-drone activists from Pakistan and around the world are gathering in Islamabad ahead of a two-day march this weekend. In Bahrain, 5 of 9 convicted medics have been arrested in a series of pre-dawn raids. The arrests come one day after Bahrain's highest court upheld their sentences for treating demonstrators during anti-government protests last year. The longest sentence went to the former senior medic at Bahrain's top hospital, Ali Al-Khari, who was given 5 years in prison. Just hours before he was arrested, Dr. Al-Khari told reporters he was unsure when he would be detained.
In regards to our reaction to the verdicts today, by reinforcing the appeals court verdict, we were expecting that. And we know that we are still targeted as medics for our role in the pro-democracy movement. I met with some today, and they expected the same, that there will be reinforcement for the verdict. And they believe also that they are innocent and they did no misdoing or wrongdoing.
That was Bahraini medic Ali Al-Khari speaking just hours before his arrest. He now faces up to 5 years behind bars. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has filed a lawsuit against J.P. Morgan Chase for alleged fraud in mortgage-backed securities issued by Bear Stearns. Schneiderman says investors were defrauded around $20 billion in buying packages of pooled mortgages and loans. Bear Stearns issued the securities before being acquired by J.P. Morgan Chase during the financial crisis of 2008. The case is the first against a major U.S. bank to come out of the Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities Working Group, a White House-backed task force launched earlier this year to probe fraud in mortgage-backed securities. The credit card giant American Express has agreed to pay $112.5 million to settle allegations of abusive debt collection and late fee charges, as well as deceptive marketing. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says American Express customers were illegally charged late fees based on a percentage of their debt, while others were given the impression partial payment would result in the forgiveness of their remaining balance. The company will refund $85 million to customers and pay another $27.5 million to government agencies. President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney are campaigning in Colorado ahead of their first presidential debate Wednesday night in Denver. On Monday, Romney told supporters he looks forward to make his case.
Conversation with the American people that will span almost an entire month. We'll get to describe our respective views, and I believe the people of Colorado will choose a better way forward for our country. We can't afford 4 more years like the last 4 years.
Tune in to Democracy Now! On Wednesday when we host a special expanded presidential debate in the evening, pausing after the questions to candidates Obama and Romney to include equal time responses from third-party presidential candidates Jill Stein of the Green Party and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party. That's Wednesday night. We'll be beginning our broadcast at 8:30 Eastern Standard Time. The Republican National Committee has reportedly ended its bid to register new voters in key states ahead of the November election after a company hired to run its registration effort was accused of systematic voter fraud. Election officials in at least 9 Florida counties have reported questionable voter registration forms submitted by the right-wing firm Strategic Allied Consulting. The Republican National Committee's canceled its contract with the firm, which was reportedly the only vendor it had hired to register voters. Despite a reported history of similar voting scandals, Republicans had paid firm, millions of dollars, including more than $1.3 million in Florida. Police in riot gear arrested at least 17 protesters who sat down in the middle of a road leading to a Walmart warehouse in Elwood, Illinois, Monday, in a bid to support striking workers. The arrests were made after some 600 people sang, chanted, and marched toward the warehouse, which is run by a contractor but supplies Walmart stores. Warehouse workers went on strike more than 2 weeks ago, amidst allegations of sexual harassment, dangerous working conditions, unpaid wages, and retaliation against organizers. Managers reportedly fired several leaders and threatened others after they delivered a petition. The strike in Illinois follows another strike by some 36 workers at a Walmart supply warehouse in Southern California who've also pushed for fairer workplace conditions. Demonstrators rallied here in Washington, D.C. Monday to mark the first anniversary of D.C.'s Occupy movement. Occupy protesters camped out in D.C.'s Freedom Plaza after the initial Occupy Wall Street protests sprung up in Manhattan's Zuccotti Park last fall. On Monday, Occupy protesters marched through the streets, blocked traffic, and protested at the offices of lobbyists and corporations. And the scientist, activist, and former presidential candidate, Dr. Barry Commoner, has died at the age of 95. Dr. Commoner was an early advocate of environmental awareness and ran for president in 1980 to spread his ecological message. In a statement, the consumer advocate Ralph Nader said, quote, "Dr. Barry Commoner should be considered the greatest environmentalist of the 20th century. His great work is reflected in his many campaigns that succeeded and in raising public consciousness to the silent violence of toxic pollution." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Washington, D.C. We begin today's show on Afghanistan, where the U.S. has waged the longest war in its history. This week, the official U.S. military death toll in Afghanistan passed the 2,000 mark. On Monday, a suicide bomber killed 14 people, including three U.S. soldiers, in an eastern province of Khost. Witnesses say the bomber was wearing an Afghan police uniform. Meanwhile, the head of NATO has revealed Western forces may withdraw from Afghanistan sooner than expected. In an interview with The Guardian newspaper, NATO's Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, admitted the killings of almost 50 allied troops this year by Afghan security forces has damaged the relationship between the international forces and the Afghan police and military. In addition, The New York Times reports the United States has all but written off hopes of working out a peace deal with the Taliban. To talk more about the situation in Afghanistan, we're joined by Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written several books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer, and Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.N. Defy U.S. Power. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Great
2,000,
to be with
the mark has been hit of U.S. soldiers killed in Afghanistan.
You know, there's a big question, for one thing, about when the actual milestone was reached. We're hearing from some media, the Washington Post, the Business Week said it was this week, this past weekend. The New York Times had actually said it was last August, and CBS News said it was last June. So even when the count gets there is up for grabs. But I think what's more important is that that speaks to the fact that the counting is not the point. The 2,000th U.S. soldier, whether it was this week or last June, is no more or less important than the first or the 17th or the 129th. And what's particularly left out in all of these counts is the scores of thousands, we don't know the numbers, of the number of Afghan civilians that have been killed in this war. Since the records began to be kept, which was not until 2007, we know that 12,996 civilians, Afghan civilians, have been counted by the U.S. military just in those last 5 years. The first 6 years were not even counted, including the massive carpet bombing of Afghanistan that opened the war on beginning October 7th of 2001. So we're faced with this massive level of casualties, giving rise to the kind of anger across society that is leading to these so-called insider killings. The U.S. military, of course, has acknowledged that only about 25% of those killings actually have anything to do with a, quote, Taliban infiltrator. The vast majority, they say, we don't know, but it seems to be personal animosity, personal grudges. What seems clear is that the personal grudges are actually grudges against an illegal occupation that is widely despised throughout the region. So when you see the rising number of casualties, and the casualties have continued to rise throughout the years of the surge and continuing to rise now that the surge troops, the 33,000 official surge troops that President Obama sent in the first year of his presidency, those are now on their way out, but the number of casualties continues to rise. The consequences will be the same whether we pull out the troops last week, as I would have preferred, or at the end of 2014. There's going to be, unfortunately, almost certainly, a violent struggle for power in Afghanistan, very much like what happened the last time a foreign occupation ended. And in that case, when the Soviet Union pulled out, There was a six-year civil war until finally the Taliban won that war with the support of the majority of the population at the time, because they promised to bring an end to war. What this is going to mean politically, we don't know yet. The fact that the U.S. is now saying that they are not prepared to go forward on efforts to bring the Taliban into peace talks does not bode well for the possibility of the war ending sooner rather than later, because what we know is that all wars, and this is, as you said, the longest war in U.S. history, every war ends with some kind of negotiation, some kind of discussion, some kind of agreement. That can be now, or it can be at the end of 2014. It's not going to qualitatively change the nature of that agreement or what happens on the ground. What we need to worry about is that what the Obama administration is saying it plans for the end of 2014 is not the withdrawal of all troops and all U.S.-paid mercenaries, as we saw in Iraq when the U.S. was forced out. This time around, we're hearing what we originally heard about Iraq. We're going to withdraw the combat troops, meaning we will keep in place the trainers. They're the ones that are being killed in the largest numbers. We will keep in place the CIA. We will keep in place special forces. And we don't know how many thousands of troops that may mean. There are now 100,000 U.S.-paid contractors operating in Iraq, along with 40,000 other NATO troops. Nothing is being said about the contractors. Will they be withdrawn, or will their numbers continue to escalate so we have essentially a continued occupation, but not with uniforms? In this situation, where we're seeing this so-called green-on-blue attacks, meaning attacks by Afghans on U.S. soldiers, we also have to compare it to what we might call blue-on-blue attacks, which is suicide. The numbers of soldiers committing suicide is higher than those being killed by Afghans or those being killed by the so-called enemy. And in that context, I think we have to look again to the reality of what this war has come to represent. It is not bringing freedom and democracy to Afghanistan. It is not making Americans safer. It's not something that U.S. troops serving in Afghanistan are able to grapple with, and we're seeing that very stark reality in the high number of suicides.
And the difference between the major party candidates for president, Obama and Romney, on Afghanistan?
The difference at this point is rhetorical. President Obama has kept his campaign promise of 2008, when he said he would withdraw the troops from Iraq and he would escalate in Afghanistan. He has done both. Candidate Obama has now stopped talking about Afghanistan this time around. Candidate Romney has said that Obama is not tough enough, but what he has called for has not been different in any substantive way. He has said that we should keep troops there, not pull out right away. President Obama is not pulling out right away. So there's very little substantive difference.
And the drone strikes ongoing in Pakistan and in Yemen. At least 35 Americans have gone to Pakistan, part of a Code Pink delegation, and they'll join tens of thousands of others, mainly Pakistanis, who will march in Waziristan at great personal risk. Talk about the escalation of the drone attacks under President Obama.
The drone attacks have become, in many ways, the signature war of President Barack Obama. This is the war that he has given the most attention to. It has escalated the most dramatically, not only in Afghanistan, but also, as you mentioned, in Yemen, also in Somalia. There are reports of other lower-level drone strikes going on in other countries as well. The idea has been that this is cheap and safe, meaning it's safe for U.S. pilots because they are not in the air. It turns out that it's neither cheap nor safe. It's cheap on one level, but when we're looking at the new Time magazine report, for example, it indicates that it actually costs more to keep an armed drone in the air, more in people costs, in personnel costs, and in the cost of the equipment itself than an F-16. It's not more safe for people on the ground, and we know that more civilians are being killed by huge numbers rather than the people on the so-called kill list. That raises a whole other level of illegality that is being committed by the Obama administration in this period, where the idea that a kill list is being created, apparently being approved by the president himself, that gives authority without any kind of judicial oversight to the idea that some people of any citizenship, including U.S. citizenship, can be placed on a kill or capture list and subject to the ultimate punishment, to death, without any kind of oversight by any outside agency.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we just returned early this morning from Blacksburg, Virginia, from Virginia Tech. In 2007, the scene of the shooting massacre that killed 32 people. What about gun violence as the presidential candidates debate domestic policy on Wednesday night? Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're on the road on a 100-city tour. On the eve of the first presidential debate, President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney are being urged to address the problem of gun violence. Wednesday's debate is taking place less than 10 miles from the site of the Columbine school shooting and 15 miles from the Aurora Theater, where 12 people were killed in July. A new bipartisan ad created by survivors of recent massacres and the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns is set to air nationally on Wednesday. The ad is called Demand a Plan, and featured Stephen Barton, who survived the Aurora mass shooting.
We're in a movie theater in Colorado. I was shot in the face and neck. But I was lucky. In the next 4 years, 48,000 Americans won't be so lucky, because they'll be murdered with guns in the next president's term. Enough to fill over 200 theaters. So when you watch the presidential debates, ask yourself, who has a plan to stop gun violence? Let's demand a plan.
United Against Illegal Gun Support Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Early this morning, I came back from Blacksburg, Virginia, from Virginia Tech, and spoke with a survivor of another massacre. His name is Colin Goddard. He was shot four times during the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre that left 32 people dead. He now works for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He was later featured in a documentary called Living for 32. As we walk through the Virginia Tech campus, I began by asking Colin Goddard to describe just what happened on that day of the massacre, April 16, 2007.
We're right here behind Norris Hall, where the shooting happened. I mean, this was where I used to walk to class from parking my car every day. So it's been a while since I've been back here, but looks the same.
What class were you taking?
I was taking intermediate French, had classes here Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and was, you know, picked up another classmate of mine that Monday morning, and we drove, parked on off campus right over there, and, you know, debated on skipping, actually, but instead we took this walk and went through this door right here.
Let's go in.
So here in the middle of Norris Hall, this is the hallway that resembled the hallway back in 2007. You can see with the same kind of cinder block walls and white tile floor. And the hall where the shooting happened is now much different. I mean, it's now it's wood panel floor. I mean, it's got a much nicer look to it, in my opinion, and it really changed the look of the whole place. So when I come back here now, you know, it doesn't remind me exactly of what happened, but I mean, I still remember this hallway, but it looks much different now, and I know where I am, you know. They put the numbers back on the rooms, which are not exactly the same numbers as numbers in each room of the shooting, but they're close. Like my room 211 was probably right around here somewhere. And I was told that there was never going to be numbers associated with these rooms. So I was kind of shocked to learn last year when they put numbers back on.
So tell us what happened here. What time did you get to school?
So I got to school probably a little late, 9:05. Got into class here probably closer to 9:10. Teacher just kind of rolled her eyes as usual. Colin's coming late, and classes was normal. I think we were, conjugating French verbs, passé composé, imparfait, and then another student came in late. Let's go, Rachel, who was like the best student in our class. Always in the front. It was very shocking that she came halfway through class, and so we all looked at her and turned around and said, "Rachel, what gives? Why'd you even come today? Class is almost over." And she turned around and she faced us, and I'll never forget. She said, "There was a shooting in my dormitory this morning, and they wouldn't let anybody leave. They had the whole place on lockdown. I kept telling them I had class to get to, but they wouldn't let me go until finally they said, 'You're free to go.' And so I came right here." And that's when we all looked at each other like, "What? There was a shooting on campus? Like, why hadn't we heard about this before? I mean, she said this happened hours before, and, just 30 minutes ago, I was off campus." But we thought, well, okay, they let Rachel go. Things must be under control. And didn't think much else of it. And then, probably about 5 minutes after Rachel coming in, when things, were just normal, we heard this loud, like, bang, bang, bang. And this was coming from, down the hall, behind closed doors. We honestly thought that it actually was coming from outside. They were working on that building right across that whole semester. So we heard all sorts of strange noises, and we chalked it up to more construction noise. The teacher resumed, and seconds later, we heard a much louder bang, bang, bang. You could tell this was something, in this hallway. This was not something outside. And the moment we heard those second bangs, the teacher's expression just dropped. You could tell she was very concerned with what that was. I still didn't even know what that was. It was kind of a shock, disbelief. Is that really a gun? So she went immediately to the doorway to look to see what was making all the noise. And as soon as she opened the door, she slammed it back shut, and she turned around all of us and told all of us to get underneath our desks. And she asked somebody to call 911. And for the first time in my life, I don't know, how or why I did, I pulled out my phone and I dialed 911. And I heard the woman on the dispatch, and I said, "Look, I think there's someone shooting a gun here in Norris Hall. I don't know exactly what's going on." And the woman said, "Norris Hall?" I said, "Yeah, Norris Hall, Blacksburg." She said, "Blacksburg?" I said, "Blacksburg, Virginia, America." And she realized that my Nextel phone had contacted Nextel Emergency somewhere in Ohio. So the woman had no idea where I was. Finally, I gave the location. She transferred me to Blacksburg Police. I stated, where I was again. "I think there's someone shooting a gun in Norris Hall." When at that moment, we had bullets come through our classroom door. And at that point, everyone just jumped to the ground. There was only one door to our room. I remember looking at the windows, thinking of going to the windows across the room, but in retrospect, I probably wouldn't be here now if I had done that. I jumped under the desk next to me. I tried to turn it over and cover myself. I really was only had seconds, and it was in total shock. I was just conjugating French verbs, and now someone's shooting me. And it came full circle. I really understood the situation that I was in once I felt one of those gunshots above my knee. I felt like someone had kicked me with all their might, and that kick sensation kind of faded into this sharp, stinging, burning sensation that kind of faded into this warm wetness, and then kind of faded into numbness, and I remained pretty much numb from head to toe the entire 9.5 minutes, and probably the longest 9.5 minutes of my life. At the end of it all, there were 17 people in my classroom, including my teacher, and now I'm one of 7 people who are still alive. The gunshots that we had heard were other classrooms down this hallway that he had visited. And this is all things that I've learned after the fact, that police gave me a walkthrough a month later and told me many things that I could remember being very alert, very conscious. I couldn't remember all the entire ordeal, and was able to piece a lot of it together through their information. But when they pulled me out of this room, ultimately, they laid me somewhere here in the hallway for a while. The girl I had driven to class that day, Christina, was lying with me. I remember she looked like she was about to fall asleep. So I kept trying to talk to her, keep her awake. You know, I knew that I was going to be okay when the police were there. Yeah, I remember looking at the SWAT team members' eyes, and they looked like, you know, full moons. They were so big. You know, they were so on edge, so alert. And they asked me if I could get up and leave, and I said, there's no way I can get up. I didn't know that I had a broken leg at that point. One of the bullets broke on my leg. I had received 4 shots in total at that time. And
where?
Above my knee, in both of my hips, and then through my shoulder. This is the only one that ever exited. I still have 3 bullets here in small pieces all over my hips and my knee. But once they realized I wasn't going to get up, they put a cop on each leg and a cop on each arm and had to pick me up and walked me all the way down the hallway, down the flight of stairs, and out to the front door. And they laid me on the grass right outside and cut off my clothes, tried to figure out where I was bleeding, tried to stop the bleeding, and called an ambulance ultimately and threw me in it with another student who had been shot in the arm, and we took off to the hospital. That by the time we were en route to the hospital, the closest hospital to our campus was already full of students and faculty. So we had to go to the hospital 30 minutes down the road. So, yeah.
How many students and teachers were in your class?
There was 16 students, and my teacher made 17. My teacher was killed, probably one of the first people in the class, and then 9 other students were killed. So I think my French class was the worst ratio of students shot and injured and killed. I don't know why. I mean, you know, we did very little differently than other people in other classrooms. The 7 of us who did survive were all located in the same corner of the classroom, the back right corner. I think there just must have been a lot of people and bags and desks in the way for him to not kind of methodically walk around us as he did in other parts of the classroom and as I learned that he did in other rooms. I never heard him say a word, never heard anyone really talk. It was pretty quiet.
Did you see him clearly?
I saw, when I dove to the floor the first time, I looked towards the front of the classroom once and saw someone with military boots, with khaki pants, with a white shirt, and with 2 holsters over both shoulders. And at that point, I stopped looking, and I turned away. So I never saw the person, no. And when the police asked me to help identify who it could be, I couldn't tell them the description. I didn't know. I realized who I was looking at the time was the person, and that was enough for me.
And what happened to him?
Ultimately, after about 9.5 minutes, once the police had entered our building, and you could tell they were very close, I remember hearing them move in the room above us. And the girl, a girl next to me, Emily, had actually retrieved the phone that I had called the police with that I just kind of thrown out of my hand, trying to act natural. And she had actually tucked it underneath her hair and remained online with the police the entire time. And she told them, he's here, he's in 211, when they came right here. And moments before they came in, he shot himself in the head in the front of our classroom. That I didn't know about until the police entered the room. And the first thing that they said was, shoot her down. And that's when I realized it was all over. And I was going to be okay. But yeah, looking at this now, it's different. I mean, now this is the Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention. I mean, I don't think you could have turned something, you know, so bad into something so good. You know, and I think that's what I try to do with my life and what I'm doing now with the Brady Campaign is to take a negative experience and turn it towards something positive. So what happened here does not happen somewhere else.
Where is the Center for Peace Studies?
It's that wall right there. Yeah, the Global Technology Center is part of where they can hold international conference calls, and they have streaming TVs. But the actual Peace Center offices are just right over there. And the first director of the Peace Center was the late husband of my French teacher. He was another faculty member here on campus and started this whole Peace Center, which, you know, he does wonderful things. Dr. Yerzy Nowak, and, you know, for the man to come back to the same place where his wife was killed and work every day and try to find some good in it, you know, it's powerful. So, yeah, you know, my room was 211. They don't go up that high. Mm-hmm. But it was just in, they've named some of the other classrooms here after the teachers who were killed.
So here we're walking past the Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention.
Yeah, that almost wasn't to be. They almost destroyed this entire building, and we're going to put up a permanent landmark in its place. I think it was a good idea to keep the building here because, you know, the face of our school hadn't changed. You know, this building is still here. And now it's on to something better. I also heard that there's a lot of scientific equipment in the bottom basement that was built here that really can't be disassembled and replaced. So I think kind of all of that together may make them decided to keep it as it is. But to renovate it, and like I said, and not to put it back to classroom use, but to turn it into a center for peace studies, is, I don't really know what else you could do better than that, in my opinion.
So, Colin, since that time, you've learned a lot more, for example, about the shooter and how he came to be in this hallway and having killed so many, 32 altogether that day.
Right. I think, you know, first, you know, after the shooting, I was really upset, really angry with him, obviously. That why did he do something like this? And learning more about his past, I learned that this was someone who had been ridiculed and tormented throughout his entire time in school, grade school, high school, you know, that ultimately couldn't connect with society and ultimately, I think, had to go out showing society how much it hurt him. You know, he had warning signs that the school was aware of. You know, he had been arrested for stalking girls on campus months before and ultimately sent to a mental health facility where he was evaluated by a judge and was adjudicated to be a danger to himself. And with that adjudication under federal law, that prohibits you from buying a gun. But in Virginia in 2007, they only sent those records to our background check system if you're then told to get inpatient therapy. Joe was told to get outpatient therapy. So his record never made it into the background check system. So several months after that incident, instead of signing up for therapy, he went to the gun store down the road from campus and went over the internet and bought a Glock 9mm and a Walther 22 and a couple hundred rounds, and then ultimately walked into this building a couple months after that and killed 32 people and himself.
Professor Giovanni, a few years before that, threatened to resign if he wasn't removed from her class.
Yeah, I think his behavior was kind of alarming. I mean, not only to raise the flag of several teachers directly, but to raise the flag of his peers, of you know, other people who lived on this campus, other students, you know? I mean, you know, why was he never dealt with appropriately? Why was he never given the help that he was so badly asking for, you know? You know, hindsight is 20/20 in retrospect, but God, if you learn something from that, you got to change it. You know, you can't let this same situation happen somewhere else.
And now Aurora massacre victims are coming to meet with you?
Yeah, and now it has happened somewhere else, this time in a movie theater in Colorado, by another young person who obviously had problems and should never have had his hands on a gun in the first place. And as time develops, you know, from the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, we'll learn more and more about this particular person and what the school knew about him, and probably we'll find more people who said, yeah, you know, there were some warning signs and he should never have had that gun that he had. And unfortunately, it takes horrible incidences in this country to get things changed, but, you know.
You're leading a campaign for President Obama and Mitt Romney to be asked in the first presidential debate by the moderator, Jim Lehrer. Well, why don't you tell us what you're asking for?
The first presidential debate of this election is happening literally miles from both Columbine High School in Aurora, Colorado, two of the worst shootings in our country's history. This is a debate about domestic policy. You know, if there ever is a time to pose a question about gun policy in America to our candidates for president of this country, then this debate that's happening on Wednesday is the time to do it. And we can't afford to have a vague question asked about this that will get platitudes. We need a specific question asked about specific policies and specific ideas that both candidates have and how they will stop another 48,000 Americans who will be murdered with firearms during their next 4 years in office. I mean, this is not a public health issue of utmost concern to our candidates, then they don't have my vote.
Colin Goddard shot four times during the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre that left 32 dead. He now works for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Up next, Professor Nikki Giovanni from Virginia Tech. She taught the shooter. Stay with us. A 15-second break. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on a 100-city tour. I've just returned from Blacksburg, Virginia, from Virginia Tech, where we continue our discussion on gun violence, a topic many are hoping will make it into Wednesday night's presidential debate in Denver. The day after the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre, the community held a ceremony in memory of the 32 victims. Among those who spoke was the famous poet and Virginia Tech professor, Nikki Giovanni.
We are Virginia Tech. We are sad today, and we will be sad for quite a while. We are not moving on. We are embracing our mourning. We are Virginia Tech. We are strong enough to stand tall tearlessly. We are brave enough to bend to cry and sad enough to know we must laugh again. We are Virginia Tech. We do not understand this tragedy. We know we did nothing to deserve it, but neither does a child in Africa dying of AIDS, neither do the invisible children walking the night away to avoid being captured by a rogue army, neither does the baby elephant watching his community be devastated for ivory, neither does the Mexican child looking for fresh water, neither does the Appalachian infant killed in the middle of the night in his crib in the home his father built with his own hands being run over by a boulder because the land was destabilized. No one deserves a tragedy. We are Virginia Tech. The Hokie Nation embraces our own and reaches out with open heart and hands to those who offer their hearts and minds. We are strong and brave and innocent and unafraid. We are better than we think and not quite what we want to be. We are alive to the imagination and the possibility we will continue to invent the future. Through our blood and tears, through all this sadness, we are the Hokies. We will prevail. We will prevail. We will prevail. We are Virginia Tech.
I sat down with Nikki Giovanni on Monday at her office at Virginia Tech, where she's a university distinguished professor. Nikki Giovanni recounted her experience of the 2007 massacre. I asked her about the Virginia Tech shooter, Seung-Hui Cho, who she taught in a poetry class. She rarely talks about him.
I taught Mr. Cho. Mm-hmm.
You taught him. You wanted him out of your class.
No, he had to leave my class. I didn't want. That had to be. Whatever it was, I wasn't trying to judge Mr. Cho. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm just a writing teacher. But
and a social worker.
Well, I didn't graduate. I did publish some books, but I never got out of social work school. But Mr. Cho, whatever it was, it truly was the damp blanket on the fire, and something was wrong. He was not participating. I'm not here to tutor. I'm here to teach. And after a certain point, you have to say, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. There are a lot of students here that would not enjoy class with me, you know, and I understand that. And there are a lot of students, I think, who get something out of the way I try to access information for them. But it was not working, so and I don't have private conversation with students. You need to know that. Then it's subject to interpretation. Whereas if you say what you have to say in front of the class, then everybody knows what you've said. And so when, I don't know, about the third or fourth day in fourth class day, which would make it second, third week, I said, you know, Mr. Cho, I think this is not working. Because every day I would have to, I teach the Tuesday, Thursday, it would be because he had a hat and pulled over. He said, well, you can't do that. And it's, Mr. Cho, please take your hat off. You know, and that would be, we'd go through that. And then, Mr. Cho, please take your dark glasses because we have them, you know. And it's just like, no, this has to stop because this is a will struggle. Now, first of all, I'm not your girl for will struggles. You know, that's just not what I do. And so I finally said, Mr. Cho, this relationship is not working. I'm not teaching you. And actually, I'm not teaching the class because I'm expending a lot of energy on you, and I don't. This is just not what we can do here. So I would like for you to find a class that you would prefer to be in, and I will speak to, because it's beyond drop ad, and I'll speak to whomever, and we'll get you all settled, and that'll be fine. And he said, I don't want to leave. And I said, Mr. Cho, this is not column A and column B. What I'm trying to say, as gently as I know how, is that you have to leave my class. You see, you have to leave my class. Now, can I help you go someplace else? And he said, I don't have to, Lou, and I'm not going to. And I said, no, let me try this one more time, Mr. Cho. Either you or I will not be in class next Thursday. One of us will be gone. If I have to keep you in class, then I will resign, and that will solve that. If Virginia Tech has to make a choice between you and me, I dare say I think they'll keep me. But this is something we'll just have to work out. And I meant it. And I said in front of the class because I wasn't trying to, he had to go. And so I went to my department head, Lucinda Roy, and I had been dealing with the fact that there's just something so wrong here. But mostly it's disrupting my class. I've taught students that had difficulties. I've taught a student with Tourette's. I've taught students that are autistic. I've taught alcoholics. I've taught ex-soldiers who are nervous. Whatever this was very different, and I wasn't going to subject myself. And so I said that to her. This is the way this is. Either you get him out of my class, or Thursday morning, you'll have my resignation. It's just that simple to me. I came here with a job, and I'll leave with one. So I'm fine. And Lucinda said, well, she talked to whoever she had, I suppose, and she said, well, would you mind if I tutor him? I said, I really don't. I don't care what we... This is my bottom line. He has to go. And I didn't see Mr. Cho, but one other time between... That was in, like, I suppose 2005, maybe four. I didn't see him but one other time between then and the shooting. I know that Mr. Cho was not looking for me. I know there was not even, because everybody knows I'm not even on campus on Monday. This is an unusual day. I know that whatever it was, he had it planned. I'm not a big fan of the mental breakdown. They plan, whether it's Aurora, Colorado, or whether it's the man that shot Representative Gifford and the federal judge. They plan, but then all of a sudden they have this, they're mentally incapable, mentally incapable. They can buy a gun and buy bullets. Then I think they're very well capable. I think the guns are not one of our good ideas. I read the Constitution, and I didn't see anything that said that any fool that wants a gun should have one. What did I miss?
And so it happened. Where were you at the time?
I was coming back from San Francisco. I had been to a principal's meeting in San Francisco, and I'm a big fan of what I call something. And I had made my presentation to the principals, and it was high school conference, and I was to have dinner with a group that evening so that we could continue. And something said, you need to go home. I'm a poet, so whatever the universe talks to me, something said. I mean, I've shared this before. It's not. Something said, you need to go home. And I thought, well, if I leave now, if I leave downtown San Francisco, I can be at SFO by 9. If I get SFO at 9, I can be on the 1050 red eye. And that's what I was shooting for. And so I did. And I said to the principals, I said, I'm really sorry, but I just really have a strong feeling. I need to go. I was thinking maybe something was happening in San Francisco that I needed to. I was never thinking I was coming into a buzzsaw. Really didn't have a premonition, just like I need to go. And so I flew all night into Charlotte. And when we got in Charlotte, the winds were, and we bound. I sleep. I could sit right here and sleep with these lights on. It's a gift. God has given me a great gift. I can sleep anytime. And we started bouncing into Charlotte, and I was like, whoa, you woke up. And so we got into Charlotte, I don't know, 6:15, it's the red eye gets in. And we should have been on the 9 o'clock to come up here, but the winds were too bad. And so they announced that it wasn't, so I put my, I fly with my ears on. And so I just was in there, we're on the econ course, if you know Charlotte, and went back to sleep just waiting for the announcement, what we're going to do. And then the next one canceled because of the winds. But the airport doesn't let you have information. And if you think that's news you're watching, you're really crazy. They have wiped out anything that will scare you. So we had no idea. And I say we, those who were coming into Roanoke had no idea what was going on, absolutely none. And we flew in, and they finally said, we think we can make it. And so we're used to it here in Roanoke that you make the run for it because we're in the valley. So if there's anything that's around, it's a problem. And they said, you know, we're going to go now. And that meant if you weren't there, they loaded that plane and we were gone. And I was ready, you know. And so we flew in because you come in on crosswinds. And we did get down. And, you know, the kids live on their phones, on their iPhones or whatever it is. And a girl said, oh, my God. I was sitting in like 13, I think. I think I was sitting in 13. So she was about an 11, and she was like, oh, my God, she said, there's been a shooting at Tech. 12 people. And she said, no, 21 people. And the whole plane, you know, is going like, what? You know, and we all, everybody's, oh, no, you must be able to say, you know, it's bad enough, but it's probably one or two that you're looking at. And I weigh about 140 pounds, and as I came out of the plane, the winds were so strong that one of the guys came and got me and just kind of hugged me. And, you know, it wouldn't have blown me away, but it was going to be pretty hard. And he brought me in, and you walked upstairs. And, of course, now we've got real news going because it's coming in real time. And at that point, it was 21, and then it went to 25. And normally I take something called the SmartWay bus, which is, at that point, it was a dollar to take the bus from the airport to come to Tech. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. And then I'll get a ride home because I didn't have my car. And when we saw that it was 25 and rising, I ran down to Hertz and got one of the last cars because it was a piece of, I want to call the name, but it was a piece of junk that I was ashamed to be seen in. And I was driving home trying to find news. And I don't know what you've done in your, I was, I don't know what the term is. I covered the Biafran War. I don't know if I was privileged or crazy or what, but that's the only war zone I've been in. And it's a very strange feeling when you're in a war zone and you start with your radio, you can't get anything. And I turned the radio on. It was a regular car. It was, like, you know, not serious. I'm just regular AM radio. And so I'm turning, and I thought I'd get NPR because VT is on. And couldn't get that. I thought, whoa, that's not good because it felt like a coup. And I kept turning and turning. So I went to Radford because Radford has a really nice station. I thought Radford will give me some information because now I'm alone in a car trying to figure out what's going on, and we couldn't get Radford. I finally was able to get a station quite a distance here. It's called Rock of Virginia, and it's a rock station. It's Rock of Virginia. And he had someone in Norris, and the person he had on the cell phone in Norris was relaying to him.
Norris is
where the shootings occurred. And so at that point, there were no shootings. Of course, we now know the shootings were over, but we didn't know it then. So we're getting that report from NARS, and that's all of the information. So you felt like you were in the third world, that there had been a coup. And about that time, WDBJ just shot past me. I mean, I was probably doing, I speed, that's why I got the ticket the other day. I have a pretty heavy foot, and they shot past. They must have been doing 120 miles an hour. They just went, shoo. And I thought, that was WDBJ. So WDBJ shot past me.
This is the radio.
WDBJ is hometown station, Channel 10. And you see them around. This is an automobile, you know, but they had to be doing 120. So I did know this is serious. I don't live in Blacksburg. I live in Christiansburg. So when you come up the expressway, Christiansburg is first, and then you go on. And they had blocked Blacksburg off. You could not get into Blacksburg. And that was like, oh. So I couldn't come on. You couldn't get into Blacksburg. And it was like, oh, my God. And my phone, I have three lines that come into my house plus my mobile. I've never understood how people got my mobile. But all of a sudden, I went home because there's nothing else to do. I turned on the television, and all of my lines were lit up, just all of them. It's like, oh. A friend of mine from Cincinnati called, and he said, are you all right? And I said, I am all right, and I think I know who did this. Because I couldn't think of anybody but Mr. Cho. And somebody else said, I was talking later in the afternoon, and somebody said, well, you know, you shouldn't say things like that. I said, maybe I shouldn't, but I would bet. And I was right, it was Mr. Cho.
And it was you who gave this rousing statement at the rally.
Well, I got a call from the president's secretary. That's how I got to know her, actually, and I love her so much, Sandy Smith. And she called, she said, well, we need you to They had, I mean, these are not things I knew. I still can't get into Blacksburg. She said, we're going to have convocation tomorrow, and we want you to wrap up convocation. And there's nothing to say but yes. It's a sad time. It's still a sad time. And I wasn't sure. I knew that I was upset because I lost friends. And I thought, well, I'm pretty good on my feet, but I thought, I don't want to take a chance because it's going to be sad. And so I just sat down at my computer, and I thought, we need a definition. We are Virginia. We are. And I just got lucky, you know, it worked. I was never sure, but I just didn't have any time to work on it. It was one of those things like, okay, I can't fix it. You know, you have to go with it. So I think it did its job. So I'm glad that it did. Yeah. It's still sad.
What do you think needs to be done about gun violence, about violence?
I think we need, I think guns are a bad idea. And I think guns and automobiles are probably the two things we need to eliminate. That simply because, excuse me, I'm sorry about this, they've outlived their usefulness. And I could see the point of guns when you were, you know, shooting, you know, Peter Rabbit and bringing him home and eating him, and, you know, or you were shooting, you know, Bambi because your family's hungry. But there's no sport to hunting. What makes that a sport? Tennis is a sport. The person on the other side has an ability to hit the ball back. Even football, which is violent, but I like football, is a sport. 11 guys. You hope they don't kill each other. That's a sport. I'm not even sure golf is a sport because you don't really play anybody, but the golfers get mad when I say that. But I know hunting is not a sport.
We're flying off to Colorado after this, and this professors at the University of Colorado Boulder, a number of them are very scared because these students are now allowed to carry concealed weapons onto campus. What do you say to them?
I said to my students, because Virginia had the same thing, I said, now here's going to be our problem. I said, when this happened, because that's when it came up, that we're going to, I said, this is what we're going to do if Virginia passes a law that students can carry guns. We're going to drop our clothes outside the door, and we're going to come in underwear that is form-fitting. I will, and you will, and we will have class as close to naked as we can, because I'm not going to try to teach somebody that I don't know what's in his pocket. That's that simple. And why should you all have to be bothered with me not knowing if I'm carrying, you know, a grenade? So we're all going to drop our clothes, and we'll come in, and we'll all know that we're naked and vulnerable, and it'll be fine. I meant that. That would frighten me. Then what are you supposed to say? Somebody doesn't like your interpretation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. They pull out their gun and shoot you. You remember, you're New Yorkers. Are you New Yorkers?
I'm New York.
Do you remember, because I was living in New York then, when we had the gas wars and people jumped, you know, every now and then somebody would jump in front and line in front of somebody. We had people to shoot people, to kill. No, not shoot, to kill people. We've had people in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, these are what I know of, to shoot people on over parking spots. What kind of sense do you let everybody have a gun? And what kind of stupidity? I mean, I get so tired. I'm not against the Old Testament, but I get so tired of the Old Testament. You know, well, an eye for an eye. And as somebody else said much better than I, that leaves everybody blind. Guns are an idea whose time has passed. Is that simple? Cars and guns are two things you don't need.
Do you have any message for President Obama, for Mitt Romney?
Neither one of them is standing up for anything. And I think that that's disgusting. You're running for president, then tell me what you're going to do about it. Because if you're not concerned about gun violence, what in the world are you concerned about?
Nikki Giovanni, Virginia Tech University Distinguished Professor, as we sat in her office just a few hours ago. That does it for our broadcast. Tune in Wednesday night for a special expanded coverage of the first presidential debate as President Obama and Mitt Romney square off. Democracy Now! Will broadcast live from Denver. We'll air the debate, pausing after each question to include responses from two presidential contenders left out of the debate, Jill Stein of the Green Party and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party. And our Election 2012 100 City Tour continues tonight in Boulder, Colorado. We'll be speaking at 7 p.m. at Unity Church on Thursday. I'll be speaking at the Tim Gill Center of Public Media in Colorado Springs. Check our website, tour.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Human army surplus or refusing all the lights. This radio clash on pirate satellite.
Is an urban Vietnam giving deadly exhibitions of murder by napalm.
Thank you for listening to Mindenki Yoga Radio Show. You can always find us online at our blog, which is lmv.hu/Mindenki Yoga. You can spell Mindenki Yoga like this, MINDENKIJOGA. And you can send us email, mindenkiyoga@mailbox.hu. You can also find us on Facebook. Just look up Mindenki Yoga. Same thing on Google+. Thank you for listening, and talk to you again this coming week.